And we will open a work session on House Bill 2098. Janet, can you refresh our memory?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. House Bill 2098 is one you're going to have to dust off your memory banks quite a bit. It was heard at the end of January. It was brought to the legislature at the request of the State Board of Architect Examiners. It makes a couple of technical changes, but what's the major thing that it does is allows the Board of Architect Examiners to assess a person for the expenses the board incurs in taking action against the person. This is a provision that a number of state boards and commissions have so that the cost of a disciplinary action is brought on the person who the discipline is taken against and not spread throughout the rest of the board membership through their dues. Mr. Chair, you have a dash one amendment at your place today. This was discussed at the first meeting. It does two things. First of all, it changes the wording from assessing a person for any expense of the board associated with taking action to the costs of the disciplinary proceedings. This is a narrower statement. This is in line three of the amendment. This is a narrower and more consistent language that consistent with what other boards and commissions have that provide this authority. But the new section, and Representative Esquivel may want to speak to this, is on line 10 through 12 of the amendment, the bold language in the amendment. If a person prevails against the board at a hearing, the board may reimburse all or part of the costs incurred by the person in defending against the board action. And this is not a common feature. In fact, this may be the only board or commission that will have this kind of permissive authority. Mr. Chair, Carol Halford is here, and she's the administrator of the Board of Architect Examiners. The Association of Architects, that's not their formal name, but has also seen the amendment and has not objected to the amendment. But again, Mr. Chair, this would be a new type of authority given to the board to reimburse the person. So, if there's any questions.
Did I open the work session for this?
Yeah, we're in a work session.
Okay, Carol, would you like to make some comments, please? Or do you have any? Maybe not.
I actually don't.
You're happy with the amendments? Representative Shoffler.
All or part, why should a person who prevails pay anything?
I'm sorry?
It says if a person prevails against the board at a hearing, the board may reimburse all or part of the costs incurred by the person in defending against the board action. Explain to me why the person who prevails and is innocent should have to pay anything, any cost. Why shouldn't all their costs be reimbursed?
Chair Brown, Representative Shoffler, I'm not the one who prepared this amendment, so I can't really answer that.
Maybe a good representative.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, it says, if a person prevails against the board at hearing, the board may reimburse all or part of the costs incurred by the person in defending against the board. In other words, if the board goes after you,
right,
and you have been exonerated from the problem, the board has to reimburse you at that point for your trouble. In other words, I prevail as the architect, the board doesn't, so therefore the board has to pay my costs that I've incurred.
Mr. Chair, may I
follow up?
Good representative, it says may reimburse all or part. Doesn't say it'll reimburse everything. And if you're innocent, why do you got to pay anything? Why shouldn't all your costs be reimbursed? That's my question.
Representative Kitts?
Well, that was my clarification. It does say, Representative Esquivel, it does say may reimburse. I mean, it could very easily say may not reimburse. I mean, that's why would we not have it shall reimburse? So it's more definitive.
No problem.
Shall.
I don't have a problem. Yeah. But maybe we should say shall reimburse all of the costs incurred by a person in defending against the board action, providing that they prevail.
Right.
And it does say if a person prevails.
I don't have a problem, doesn't it?
Yeah. Representative Kitts.
Is there any cause and effect on that?
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Janet, I think since the chair is looking to potentially move this bill, do you want to do a conceptual amendment?
from.
Mr. Chair, if we want to make that kind of change, we should probably take it back to Legislative Council and bring it back to another meeting.
I'm fine with that.
Mr. Chair, and members, two things. When we talked to Legislative Council about this, because it is, in effect, new ground, Legislative Council was not comfortable with making it shall because it's not, it's like the board requiring to do something against itself, and that's not something that's very common in the statutes. So the permissive language was kind of a way to get partway there, and all or part is the same thing, because if a person goes to extraordinary costs in defending themselves, the board would be required to cover those extraordinary costs. So again, this was kind of a part way to what Representative Esquivel was seeking, and it sounds like some of the other members are seeking, but it's not
all the way.
So.
Representative Esquivel.
Well, I guess, I know what we're struggling with here is that I'm innocent. Something is brought, and I'm thrown under the bus here, and I have to spend $30,000 to get out from underneath it. Who's going to pay me for that? Because I was innocent. That's what we're talking about here. I don't think that the board takes things lightly. I think it's a very serious matter with them. I think maybe this would be a start to see how it works. That may be a possibility, but I do agree with my fellow colleagues down here that, if you prevail, you prevail. That's the key word here. And you should be reimbursed for your monetary output.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I mean, obviously, if we're not going to move this, I would still be inclined to support the shall and all, because I think it sends a message to the board, quite frankly, you better be certain that you're going after people. And I don't care if it's $30,000 or $300, if it's money that I shouldn't have had to spend, not myself, but if a consumer, a fellow Oregonian, should not have had to spend, it shouldn't be his liability. I mean, so that's, I would ask the author of the amendments to make those changes, and if in fact those changes are made, I'll support the bill.
I think it's obvious that we're not accomplishing what we intended to do with the amendment, so I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2098. And then, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2409, and Janet, can you give us a summation of what the bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2409 is at the sponsored by Representative Gilman. You'll see in Section 3 of the bill that it would allow an employer to pay a minor 50 cents less than the minimum wage per hour for the first 60 days of employment. And if you look at Sections 1 and then Section 4 of the bill, it provides that for certain tipped employees, the minimum wage is established at $7.25 an hour, and it exempts in Section 1 of the bill, it exempts this $7.25 an hour wage from automatic future inflation adjustments. It would apply to employees who are required to report tips under the IRS code, who customarily receive $30 or more in tips in a month, and who have been notified by their employer before the start of their pay period that this is in effect, and that either keep their tips or receive a share of pooled tips. And finally, Mr. Chair, it forbids an employer from displacing employees or reducing hours, wages, or benefits in order to hire someone at lower hourly rates that are determined by either of the bill's major provisions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. And just so the people that are in the audience here that are here to testify understand, some of the rules I'm going to lay down is that at 10:30 we will adjourn the hearing. We have a floor session shortly after that, and so at 10:30 the hearing for today will be over. And we will try to balance the testimony so that everyone gets their opportunity to weigh in on the issue. And we have a couple, and be done by panels. couple of the initial panels setting the stage for this. I will not necessarily place any time limit on it. After that, I would ask people to keep their testimony to 3 minutes, and Janet has a timer here that will try to keep some sort of track on that. And I thank you for your cooperation with that, then, please. And with that, I'd call Representative George Gilman and Bill Perry and Debbie Caldwell, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Representative George Gilman from District 55. I think most of you know that I spent 26 years milking cows. And every summer, we had to somehow find the forage for those 300 cows, I hired hay crews. And oftentimes they were wonderful kids that were football players and wanted to get in good shape, and sometimes they were less than that and weren't quite as inspired to pick up those bales of hay and move them. I had a rule of thumb. It'd take three different individuals to finally fill a position on that hay crew, and that's the reason I instigated this bill. Is I really think that when we're doing training of young people, we shouldn't have to pay the minimum wage. That's enough for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Restaurant Association. Representative Gilman touched on the need for the training wage, so I'll probably just leave that aside for now and really kind of talk about the tip credit, which I think is sort of the tip wage, which is going to be, I think, the majority of the testimony here today. In Ms. Atkins' description, she talked about freezing at 725, and I think as we see media around this, it talks about a lower wage for employees, and one of the reasons why I included Attachment A is pulled right off the U.S. Department of Labor's website. It talks about when you look at section or subpoint 2 there, that you have to be able to show employees receiving at least minimum wage and direct wages and tip credit allowance to be continued. So if they're not getting tips, no matter where you put the minimum wage, I don't care if it's at $7.50 or $20, if they're not receiving and reporting that tip income to an employer, then you can't utilize a tip wage. For that reason, so you guys know what tip reporting is, I've included in Attachment B a sample tip report form. This or this type of a form must be turned in to an employer for a tip wage to be utilized. And you notice in the dark sections it has a tip out. So if a server by choice decides to tip out, you cannot utilize any of that money in relation to a tip wage. So if they're tipping out their bussers or back of the house people, they're allowed to do that. It will not count against them in this bill, and they still have to show on this tip out form that they're putting a certain amount of money aside. Now, what this bill does is it institutes two provisions that are in the Fair Labor Standards Act. And as that Attachment A deals with, it shows you that at the federal level, tip wage is 213. We're not asking for 213. We've never asked for 213. What we're saying is, you know, whether or not it's a good or bad policy at 725, let's just deal with it as we look forward. 43 different states have some sort of a tip wage. So this is not uncommon in our industry. And I also have a handout, Attachment C, a brochure that talks about how every other industry in the state of Oregon under ORS 653 gets to use commissions when they calculate wages. So a car salesman, retail salesman, farm worker that picks bucket of cherries or something like that, if you pay them a commission per price, you can deduct the whole thing against minimum wage. So you're required to make sure that the commissions or tips or whatever commissions exceed minimum wage. If you do that, the employer doesn't have to pay them anything. We are excluded from that. I would say that the employee has kind of more of a benefit because they get to decide, in some sense, depending on service, how much of money they can get from a consumer. The employer, in the other examples, sets that commission. A server, if she does a good job, he or she, then they have a chance to do more. Once again, he or she has to report it to an employer. So if they don't report it, I can't use it. So I would say that this, in some instances, can be a fairer addition for a server. House Bill 2409 will not make servers make less money. It doesn't. They're making a certain amount today, and they will continue to make that tomorrow if the bill passes next year and 10 years from now. There's nothing that moves these people backwards. The servers, when you look at other states, they get their increases off higher menu prices or increased table turns. They will continue to get more money based on that. If I raise the wage of my cooks, ultimately, my menu prices are going to go up. All of a sudden, the menu price goes up. The 15%, 16%, whatever they're getting, goes up. That's what this is intended to do in any sales position, is say, if I pay my wage earners more, my meal prices go up, my salespeople make more. So what we will start to do is start to implement that. I've included two studies in there, one from University of Oregon done in 1998, and it talks about on page 15 the amount of tips that a tipped employee receives. Back in 1998, a tipped employee received about $9.50 in tips and about $6 in minimum wage. The high range for a cook in 1998 was $9.49, I think it says. So back then they were making more in tips than the cooks were making in wages, and I not only was required to pay them $6 on top of that, but I've been required to give them 4 to 5 raises since then, and nothing's been guaranteed of those cooks. What you saw that study talks about is hours are decreased, hours on the floor for servers, hours for cooks, benefits start to decline. So the way this works, because I'm being forced to give my highest wage employees an increase, not only they have suffered in some instances, but also the back of the house employees have suffered. The brochure also talks about national averages. National averages in states with a tip wage, the tipped employee still makes $17 to $22. The study says that. They make $17 here. So the big problem that happens is not the servers making the same amount of money. It's being short of either a couple of employees or a couple of 50 to 60 cents an hour for a cook. The servers aren't making less money in the states where there's a tip wage of $2.13. I also do in my brochure a simple math problem where the average business person, as you talk to them out here, shows that their labor costs are somewhere in the neighborhood of 33 to 35%. When you take in $10 for a cook and $7.25 for a server, if at a 35% labor cost, that's why I've tried to run through this with all of you individually because it is complicated, it shows that if a server is not making over $7 an hour in tip income, the restaurateur is not making money. They can't pay the base wage. Now, that $14 per hour does not include all the taxes I need to pay on top of that. Workers' comp, unemployment, I pay that on both the wage and the tips. It's not calculated any differently from the federal law to the state law. I also, one of the things in Attachment A dealt with, if you look at page 2, it deals with tip pools. Many comments have been made about don't employees or servers share money with the back of the house. They're encouraged to do so, and the ones that do is much appreciated. The servers work hard for their money, though. They deserve their tip income. I don't think anybody here will deny the fact that they don't deserve their tip income. If they're a good server, I want them rewarded. The question is, though, is how far are they allowed by law to be encouraged by an employer to share money with employees? And basically, if it's a direct service personnel, meaning usually a busser, a bartender, or a runner, then federal law says you can share tips with those people. But by federal law, I'm not allowed to encourage them to spend or share with the back of the house, chefs, cooks, everybody else, the people that are basically penalized without a tip wage. And so it puts the restaurateur in a very, very unique position from the standpoint of federal law protects the server's tips. It also protects the wages for the back of the house. Now, state law removes the protection for the back of the house wages. Okay, so now I'm put in a situation where, okay, I can't encourage my servers to share with the back of the house. If they don't and I try to penalize them, I'm violating federal law. But in this scenario, the only person that's getting hurt is the cook. Okay, now on the flip side, if three or four of my servers share with the cook and one doesn't, then all of a sudden, say that cook decides not to send the food out as fast. Now, who gets penalized? The server, but also the customer, and potentially the owner. So by not participating, if they hurt my customer, I can actually penalize that cook with no retribution under law. I mean, it's the way that this set up is just not fair today. And once again, I want to reiterate, we're not saying that the servers don't deserve their tip income. I want them to be rewarded if they sell food. The question is that how do we get a fair wage for the back of the house employees? The tip wage provision, I want to reiterate, is not intended to hurt anybody, and I don't think it will hurt anybody. As we see some sort of a credit to be utilized, if tips increase and tips continue to be reported, if we have an ability to add bussers, servers will make just as much money and they won't have to clean dirty dishes. If we can basically get more money to cooks, we'll add stability to the back of the house where it is much needed. You as employers and people that have dealt with your constituents understand that health care benefits are going up. I've had to decrease health care benefits and raise deductions. But all these things happen because a tip credit is not allowed today. None of these employees in these restaurants are minimum wage employees. I think you'll hear that throughout the message today. So also we can restore lost hours for tipped employees. Each restaurant is going to handle this differently. Some of them are going to pay more to the back of the house. Some of them are going to reinstitute benefits. Some of them might hire more bussers or prep cooks to increase table turns. All these things should improve the restaurant and improve situations for all employees. 2409 is not a step backwards. It is not in any way, shape, or form a step backwards. What we're dealing with is what do we do with increases in the future. I think it is helpful and beneficial to all employees and all restaurateurs. I would appreciate it if you guys would pass House Bill 2409. Let her speak, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
My name is Deborah Caldwell. I own a small cafe in Klamath Falls. We're open for breakfast and lunch only. I think that's important that I let you know that before I speak any further. I've been in the restaurant industry for 15 years, and I first became aware of the impact of a non-tip credit in California, where I did business for 8 years. When the first minimum wage impacted my business there, I had no minimum wage workers in my restaurant, not one. Any of you who have ever been in contact with small business anywhere, in any state, California, Oregon, wherever it may be, has to acknowledge that good employees are hard to find, and they are the backbone of our industry. And I am going to pay those employees what I need to pay them to keep them around. I'm nothing without them. Anyone who has a small business has to acknowledge that good employees are hard to find, and we are going to pay them what we need to pay them to keep them around. As I said before, I had no minimum wage employees at that time. The only minimum wage employees I had were my waitresses out front who were making $100 to $150 a day in tips. And I know this because the IRS has told me that I need to make sure they report their tips as income. Income, gentlemen. The IRS acknowledges their wages as income. If I do not do everything that I can to make sure that they report all of their tips as income, I will be held and penalized by the IRS because I did not do this. The IRS supplies tip books that are government records to be maintained by the waitresses and any other tipped employee in my house. I will tell you that all of my waitresses are required by me, whether it's legal or not, to share a percentage of their tips with the house, front and back. However, as the gentleman said before, I cannot police this. If a girl walks out of my house with $120 and hands a cook two for the entire shift, that's the most I can do. That's the best I can do. Every time an increase happens in the front of the house, and this last time we had an increase in my house, again, I had no minimum wage employees except for my waitresses, who are not minimum wage employees. They're making an average of $18 an hour. When I train a new waitress, the first thing I do, she trains for 2 weeks with no tips. She walks beside the waitress and beside myself for 3 days. I take every dime out of my pocket. I count it out. I add her minimum wages to the tips, divide them by her hourly, and I have never, gentlemen, never had a girl walk out of my house with less than $15 an hour during her training period. I constantly have customers come to my register every day and say, as they fill out their charge tip, their charge receipts, I left the tip on the table. Tipping is almost a required thing anymore. No one walks out of a house and doesn't tip. No one. Every time the minimum wage goes up, I have to increase the minimum wage not only in the front of the house but in the back of my house. How can I look at my $9 an hour cook and hand my $7.25 an hour waitress, who he's watched count out her tips day after day, and say, I'm not going to give you 20 cents too? So I do. So my whole house increases. I increase the price on my menu to allow myself to continue in business. And the waitresses get another bump, because now my ticket total's gone up. Another bump on top of the minimum wage. I have no waitresses who want to work 40 hours a week. It's a hard job, and I know it's a hard job, but I'm telling you, they all make very good money and 30 hours a week. I have put many girls through college with weekends only. They drive new cars, pay for their college. You know, granted, a lot of them live at home, and all these girls aren't living on their own, but the waitress industry, to me, has never been a place where someone is going to make a career. I know and I acknowledge that there are some people who do. I do have one 40-hour server who supports her family and very well on what she makes. But this industry is a stopover industry, except for probably the back of the house. This is a place where you make money to go to school, to become an actor, to do whatever you're going to do in life. And I just, before I finish, and I want to give everybody their fair share of time today, a bigger economic impact on the state of Oregon, and I don't think you people are aware of this, but do you know that none of the major food chains have ever, and there may be one or two, have ever started on the West Coast? And do you know why that is? Because the cost of doing business is so extremely high that they choose to start back east so that they could get name recognition, get the kinks worked out. There's no room for working out kinks at these kind of wages. I literally hire people on at $7.25 an hour, and this is going back to the first issue on this amendment. I have to teach them that you can't come to work and eat your breakfast when you get there because you forgot to eat it before you came to work. I have to teach them that, you know what? No, it is, and mind you, this just happened this week, that you cannot call in 30 minutes before your shift and expect to have your shift covered in a half an hour. This girl's making $16 an hour, and I have to teach her this? This is crazy. You know what, gentlemen, this is not meant to hurt anyone. I have no problem with freezing the minimum wage at $7.25 for tip servers. I don't want to hurt anyone. I don't want anyone to have to back up. But I honestly compel you to listen to the arguments today and treat it, listen to each side and tell you, go home and ask yourselves, what argument is there really for there not being a minimum? It's 43 states acknowledge us. And you know what? We have one of the worst economies in the state. And yet, this continues. This continues. And I am going to say one last thing. Do you know what? I'm a very hard worker, and I do well wherever I go, and I think hard workers do get rewarded wherever they go. What happened to merit? You negate my merit raises every time you do this. I say to a young dishwasher, you know what? You're doing a great job. I'm going to give you 20 cents an hour more. And 2 months later, you come behind and tack another 20 cents onto it and negate his merit raise. If he would have just stayed and schlocked through the dishes for another 6 months, he would have got it anyways. And a lot of them know that. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie, for your testimony. You made a comment that you had to make these reports to the IRS on the amount of tips, apparently.
Yes.
Is this true of the State Department of Revenue, too? You said the IRS, and I assume you're talking about federal.
It's only the IRS, but I do report once. I just continue on and report them to the state as well. I don't take them off for state reporting. I report them for both. But the IRS requires us to keep accurate records and do everything we can to get them to report. A few years back, there was it was customary. They were called tip allocated houses. And if you had a certain amount of employees designated by the IRS, you were called a tip allocated house. And what you were required to do to the IRS is report 8% of your sales in the form of tips. Now, if your servers did not report at least 8%, we were allowed through the federal government to go back and allocate it equally among the servers so that at least 8% of our sales showed up in tips. Now, smaller houses like mine were not required to do that at that time. However, approximately 2 years ago, the IRS made a ruling that everyone who had tipped employees was required to make sure that they could do everything possible to make sure they reported every dime that they made, and they supply us now with small books, tip books that are regular IRS handouts that we're supposed to hand out to our employees. And if we do not make sure that they report it, and they find that like a server has not reported everything she's made, we are held accountable for the contributions as a penalty.
And is that how you know how much workers' comp to payroll charges to pay on or unemployment insurance?
By the tip reports.
Right.
I actually have the girls fill out the book, and then every payday they're required to compile that into a smaller form, into a piece of paper that they hand in to me that I compilate the payroll on.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Perry again. And after they report it, the employer is still liable under audits to pay all unreported tip income taxes affiliated with it at some time down the line if they get audited. Mm-hmm. So they don't always go after the employee in those audits, but they will require you to pay taxes on all the unreported, both state and federal taxes, on unreported tip income.
Thank you. Any questions, committee? Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Representative, when I was growing up, for about a stretch of about 10 years, there were farmers and several farm families for about 10 years had a Schaffler boy bucking hay, one right after the other. And we saw a lot of our classmates come and go, but we were so hungry we stuck it out. But actually, my question, though, is to Mr. Perry or the restaurant owner, Ms. Caldwell, if you can bet on some history on this. And by the way, I also worked my way through college washing dishes, bussing tables, waiting and bartending and doorman, so I've been there too. And that was tip credit state. But the history about letting all these commissioned workers off from this and not restaurant wait staff that many do make a good living, I know, I'm well aware of that. Why were restaurants specifically and taverns and bars excluded? And are there any restaurants, especially like the higher-end restaurants in Portland area, that do give a commission, and if they do give a commission, are they exempt from minimum wage?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, answer your first question. In 1977, when minimum wage was about $3, I don't remember what it was, Oregon, Washington, and California in that year all removed tip credit. Basically what they did, technically under law, was just took tips out of the definition of commissions. So the federal government's always treated it at 213, but Oregon before that point basically was a commission. So they removed that in 1977, and it was something, there were three newly elected labor commissioners that went through and did it. But, you know, back then it was $1 an hour, so I don't think the industry was really all that concerned. Obviously, now we're 340% when you look at a tip wage higher than the federal, so that it's starting to really create some problems. And with that, I forgot the second part of your question.
Mr. Chair, if a restaurant offers a commission to their wait staff, are they exempt from minimum?
Yeah, Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, it's kind of a unique point here. Two restaurants in Ashland decided at the last minimum wage increase that they were going to go to a mandatory service charge. And I would say to paraphrase this, if the tip is left up to the consumer, it belongs to the server. Okay? If the tip is established by the house and the consumer knows this when they walked in, it belongs to the house. So what happened in the two restaurants in Ashland was they picked, I know one of them said, well, you're reporting $12 an hour in combined income, I'll pay you $17, we'll just go to a flat rate. The server started quitting. Actually, one of the server quote from a Ashland Tidings article was, even though I was only reporting $12 an hour, I was making $24, and a lot of it was tax-free. So, you know, $17 an hour isn't a good deal for me, so they quit. The restaurant that was able to hold them, what they did was said, we will pay you $17-$18 an hour, but tell you what, I'll hold it once the Shakespearean Festival leaves, which usually tip income would decline at that point. So a lot of the servers decided the full year of guaranteed income was more of a thing. So you can do it. The problem with it is you're not rewarding good service. And, you know, and that's why we keep going back to the fact of, you know, we don't want to take tips away from anybody. I think every restaurateur in this room will tell you that a good server that gets a good tip, there's nothing better for my business in the world. And we want to encourage them. And we're better off by saying, if I've got a good server, let me give them a busser, let me give them a prep cook, let me expand their station, because if they're going to sell, I'll give them more tables. Because if they can generate table turns and generate customer counts, everybody's going to make money. And so taking the tips away from the servers is not necessarily something that is advantageous for anybody from my personal perspective. I'd be happy to have other people answer
questions. And might I add that by adding staff to the front end of my house, I have a pretty extensive line of desserts, but because we're so busy trying to turn tables some days and there isn't any sub-staff, my waitresses don't upsell as much as they could. And three pieces of cake is $10. 20% of that, you know, is a nice little bump on the end of your ticket. And having some extra sub staff up front would help that a lot. And I know your argument is going to be that these girls are going to say, well, you know, we're gonna give this up, and nobody's gonna get a bump in the back of the house, and nobody's gonna get a bump in the front of the house. You know what? I think there are always people who are going to take advantage of situations, but I guarantee you, in this competitive industry, it will be the people who take advantage of the situation and stabilize that kitchen staff and have the best cooks and have the best sub staff that are going to come on the top of this winners, and we're going to do that by increasing pay and increasing benefits to the back of the house.
Representative Schaffler.
Just a comment. Ms. Caldwell. Ms. Caldwell?
Mm-hmm.
I got a feeling, though, and I've never met you till just now, I got a feeling there ain't too many dishwashers schlocking off very long in the back of your house.
No, and I'll tell you what, my dishwashers are making upwards of $8.59 an hour, because I want the best. The best makes me the best. I will tell you that my reputation is impeccable in my little town, and granted it's a little town, but it's impeccable. And my reputation in Southern California was impeccable. I need good workers. I go through five to find one. And not to mention the money that's wasted in training and the things that go on before I finally say, you know what, this person isn't going to fly, this person isn't going to work out, and I've already spent hundreds of dollars on them. So I don't want to lose those people. And you know what? These people are very well. They do have skills that we want. We don't want to lose anyone through this. We don't want to lose anyone. Do you know how hard it is to go from 0 to 500 in 2.5 seconds? And in the restaurant industry, we ask our people to do that all the time. We do $1,000 one day and $5,000 the next. And they have to know how to do that. And that's a skill. And we're not underestimating those skills at all.
Thank you, folks, for your testimony. For time's sake, we're going to have to move on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Holman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question before you escape. I was curious, you know, we all want good employees. There's no doubt about that, and I recognize that as well. But I also think that, you know, people that work for a living should be able to make a good living. And I'm just curious, you know, you mentioned benefits, and I'm just curious of Mr. Perry, if you know what percentage of restaurants actually have health care that they pay for their employees?
Chair Brown, Representative Holby, I've been asked this question a lot of times. We did a questionnaire to our membership, but it's been 3 or 4 years, and you know, this is one of those difficult questions to answer from the standpoint of about 70% of our members back then supplied health care. Now, that being said, I mean, obviously what has happened in the time being, obviously with the premium increases and everything else, the thing that it's hard to get a judge on is how extensive those healthcare benefits go part-time, what's defined as part-time. Also, how big the deductibles go up, which they've been increasing. And so that is probably the bigger problem, is the deductibilities have been increasing at such a rate, because it's been the only way I've been able to hold on for some of them. But right now I can't tell you how close that 70 number is, but I would say more and more of our members are trying to offer health care, but these, you know, the labor costs are really kind of killing them. And I would also say the other interesting point is we've added on the back of my testimony is the number of restaurant employees per restaurant. There's only 3 states where the employees per restaurant have declined, and it's Oregon, Washington, and Vermont. And Oregon and Washington are the 2 highest minimum wage with no tip credit. Yeah, I think it all plays into when it talks to benefits or how I deal with my increases. You have to either cut back 1 or 2 employees or raise the deductibilities, and that you've seen a lot of that happen over the last 2 to 3 years.
Thank you again for your testimony. Could I have Tim Nesbitt and Josh Gibson, and is that Delete Peck? Do you like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. Chair Brown, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify and for the format you've arranged today. We appreciate that. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, appearing in opposition to House Bill 2409. You know, if this bill had been enacted last session, just after the voters raised our minimum wage, tipped workers would now be working for a minimum wage of $6.90 per hour, and new hires under the age of 18 would now be working for $6.75, or if they happen to work in tipped jobs, for $6.40, compared to our current minimum wage of $7.25 per hour. These are steep reductions, and they would have occurred in just 2 years, taking tens of millions of dollars annually from the paychecks of our lowest paid workers. Our first response to House Bill 2409 and to any of the other bills filed this session that would freeze, reduce, or carve out exceptions to our minimum wage is this: respect the will of the voters and learn from the wisdom of the voters. Our minimum wage is doing exactly what it was supposed to do. It's keeping workers above the poverty level with modest pay increases that merely match the cost of living. Those increases amounted to 15 cents per hour last year and 20 cents per hour this year. For full-time workers, that's $1.20 to $1.60 a day. For waiters and waitresses, it's pennies a plate. But penny for penny and dollar for dollar, There's no better tonic for our economy because a minimum wage worker spends almost everything he or she earns as fast as he earns it in the local community. Clearly, the minimum wage is good for working families, and it's good for our economy. Our voter-approved minimum wage law means that workers in Oregon cannot be forced to work for poverty wages. For thousands of others who earn tips in addition to the minimum wage, it means that they can take home amounts that are closer to a living wage. But a living wage is not a wealthy wage. No one is getting rich on the minimum wage. Even young people under 18 are entitled to our minimum wage, whether they're working to save for college, help their families make ends meet, or pay their own way in our consumer economy. They ought to be assured of equal pay for equal work. If they can do the job, their age shouldn't be used to discount their wage, as you'll hear this morning from witnesses who are here to represent farm workers, students, and retail clerks. But the greatest number of workers whose pay will be frozen and effectively reduced over time by House Bill 2409 are workers who earn tips. They're mostly waiters and waitresses, and there are more than 20,000 of them in Oregon who are paid at or just above the minimum wage. For them, the minimum wage serves as the foundation for a better-than-minimum income, which they earn from their hard work and good customer service in an industry that is growing and thriving in Oregon. As you will hear from waiters and waitresses today, they're not getting rich. They make their best money during peak meal times, but there are slow times when they earn very little above the minimum wage, or set up tables and wrap silverware for the bare $7.25 per hour. Because some of these workers are earning family wage incomes, the proponents of House Bill 2409 are saying, in effect, that these workers are earning too much to qualify for the full minimum wage. But is $10 an hour too much? That's the average earnings rate for restaurant servers when you look at the state's earnings data and adjust for tip sharing and possible underreporting. Is $17.10 an hour too much? That's what the Restaurant Association says is the actual average. We dispute that. Very few servers consistently earn that kind of money. Even so, a living wage for a worker with one dependent in the high-cost areas of our state is $17.60 per hour at a full 40 hours a week. Even fewer servers earn that much money. No one, not even waiters and waitresses, is getting rich on the minimum wage. Maybe this is why the Restaurant Association is using such strange arguments to make its case for this bill. On the one hand, they argue that restaurant owners should be able to freeze pay rates in the front of the house for servers and bartenders so that they can increase pay rates in the back of the house for cooks and those who clean up in the kitchen. On the other hand, they argue that servers will earn more if they work for less. Each argument is as faulty as it is absurd. In attempting to rationalize such arguments, the Restaurant Association makes a total of 18 false, misleading, and unsubstantiated statements in its brochure entitled Why a Tip Wage is Good for Oregon. We've researched, analyzed, and counted those statements in a separate document which we've submitted to you today. But I want to highlight 2 points from that document. First, restaurant workers from the front of the house to the back of the house fare worse in states with tip penalty wages. In tip penalty states, those who cook the meals, serve the meals, and clean up after the meals all make less than their counterparts in the full minimum wage states, like Oregon. A cook will make 80 cents per hour less in a tip penalty state. Servers make 61 cents per hour less in a tip penalty state. Second, there are more restaurant jobs in states that do not allow tip penalty wages than in those that do. In tip penalty states, we find an average of 12.1 servers, cooks, and others for each 1,000 residents. In full minimum wage states, the corresponding number is 13.9. Higher wage states are better for restaurant workers and better for their customers. The faulty arguments used by the Restaurant Association to legitimize a false problem are bad enough, but their proposed solution is far worse because it will hurt low-paid workers most of all, penalize women more than men, and create perverse incentives for employers to manipulate the rules surrounding a tip penalty system. By eliminating cost of living increases for all tipped workers, House Bill 2409 starts at the bottom, cutting adjustments from the base wage that means most to workers with the lowest earnings. The servers who slide hash and eggs across a Formica counter will be hurt a lot more than the servers who roll out desserts on a cloth-covered cart. Further, House Bill 2409 will hurt far more women than men, 76% of all servers in Oregon are women, compared to only 46% women in all the jobs in our state. Many waitresses are single mothers, and you will hear from one of them today. Finally, House Bill 2409 will create perverse incentives for employers to game the tip penalty system. In tip penalty states, management consultants are now advising their clients in the restaurant sector to apply the tip penalty wage to cooks when those cooks share in the tips of their service. The Restaurant Association argues in its lobbying brochure that a tip penalty wage will help stabilize the industry and allow for new national chains to operate in Oregon, bringing more jobs and consumer spending. Their argument about more jobs and spending is patently false. But that statement about national chains may reveal a different truth. The people who run these corporate chains are used to operating in tip penalty states where the minimum wage for servers averages $2.59 per hour. They don't want to pay $7.25 per hour in Oregon. And that might explain why we're seeing a full court press in this building to squeeze money from the paychecks of Oregon's tipped workers. If that's the case, House Bill 2409 isn't going to help our homegrown restaurants no more than it will help our restaurant workers. Representatives, when you were campaigning for office last year, I suspect that each and every one of you talked about protecting good jobs and promoting family wages. With those promises in mind, please listen carefully to the testimony of those who follow me today. They speak from the front lines of our economy. They work hard. They value their jobs. And they'll be asking you to protect their wages. Please do so by rejecting House Bill 2409.
Thank you. Next.
Thank you for your time. I'm Josh Gibson. I'm here primarily, I think, because I've worked in a tip credit state and have experienced that reality. Again, I feel the need to address the fact that it's been hinted at in some ways that I make too much or enough money. I would like to know if anybody would agree with that assertion. Think that I make too much or enough money? Because this is a suggestion to cut wages for minimum wage employees, to go below the minimum, a training wage that goes below the minimum. I say if I show up to work and I'm training, maybe paying me the absolute minimum is enough of a training wage. Do you want to live in that kind of community? I'm going to give you the minimum, and I'm going to expect more of you as an employee because I lived in that community in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we had a higher crime rate because that's what that attitude engenders in my mind and in my experience. In a tip credit state as a waiter, I actually made less than $5 an hour, less than the federal minimum wage, on many shifts working in a restaurant that was about to go under. It just wasn't doing well, and it eventually did close. We had our weekend nights. That made up for all of that. So I'd make $3 or $4 an hour during lunch because there was virtually no customers coming in. This is my salary, my tip wage, or my tips and my wage. Then Saturday comes, and you can rely on making $100 at night, which in Albuquerque at the time was still a fair amount of money. But the first time my Saturday shift came up, the employer had gotten customer complaints. So he decided we needed more waiters on the floor. And at $2 an hour, it's $2.13 at the time, why not? So if I'm making so much money in tips, let's remember that we potentially jeopardize the need for ownership to cut payroll costs by having less waiters on the floor. They brought up the argument themselves that they can put more staff out there. Well, more staff out there means further divisions of the tips that come in. A busy waiter is a happy waiter, and a busy waiter is a good waiter. And I think that you could talk to 100 waiters and find out that they give the best service when they're running and not when it's slow. So we're talking about benefiting customers. We're talking about benefiting business. Okay. We're talking about also bringing this in at a time when the Oregon restaurant industry has shown growth. Now, I've heard this somewhere, but I think it's probably pretty clearly shown growth because the Restaurant Association didn't argue in any of their presentation that there was no growth because that argument would benefit them. We've had growth. It is working to pay minimum wage. It is working for servers to make that. So if we're making more money than somebody else is, If we're making more money than the back of the house, I'll stand up with you. I agree that that's not fair. But let's look at society on the whole. Is everybody compensated correctly? Is it anathema to a certain political point of view that anybody would ever suggest that we restrict the earnings that a person can make? Is that right? Is that what we're doing? And have we heard any assurance at all from the Restaurant Association that money is going to the back of the house? Because that is the big appeal of their argument. I'm not going to drive down to Salem for an hour if they propose this again and they're talking about an actual legal structure. If they want to propose legislation that's going to give back of the house employees benefits but cost employees in the front of the house, I may fight on that side. But I don't hear any assurance at all. We are basically assuming, we are hoping, that ownership will see fit to take the money that they're taking out of this minimum wage and put it at the back of the house. Call me cynical, but I just don't see things working out that way. The U.S. Constitution is a study in cynicism. Our entire economic system is based on a cynical view. Owners will cut costs. That's what they do. That's what they should do. That's what a good business person does. Costs go up invariably. So do you really trust that ownership is going to stave off the temptation when dairy goes up to maybe hire the next employee at minimum wage and keep them there a little longer? I don't know. I also know that I like handing my support staff, whether it's a busser or if it's the kitchen staff, money myself. I thank you for what you did. We have a tipping policy. I give them money. I get better from them. I get along with them. No management involved in our relationship. We get along fine. It is a way, it is a thank you as much as it is a kickdown from me. And again, there is no real presentation that suggests that those tips would be protected. Could arguably that dishwasher that I'm tipping out now be making $6.90 an hour too? Because are they by definition a tipped employee? And please let's remember, some waiters make $17 an hour. The bulk of that hourly wage is, or the hourly wage is the bulk of what a lot of tipped employees make. You're going to undermine that. And we're potentially opening the door for a full tip credit. Now we have tip credit in our rhetoric. It is my personal suspicion that that means we're headed towards $2.59 an hour. And it's going to be a lot easier for someone to push for that if we accept now that tipped employees should be paid less. Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Diet Peck. I am a single divorced mom raising two preteen daughters, and I'm trying to put myself through school. I am begging you not to put a freeze on minimum wage. I barely make ends meet as it is, and I can't count on my tips because it's not guaranteed that I will receive that money. I count on my paycheck every 2 weeks to put into my budget for the month. Some days, on good days, I will walk with $10 an hour, and that's including my wages. I do not receive medical benefits. They're not offered to me because I'm a part-time employee. I would have to work 35 hours or more to get the medical benefits. On top of that, the medical benefits that they do offer are not worth the time and effort that I would need to put into it. My vehicle is not brand new. It's 10 years old. And I really struggle each month because I'm also trying to put myself through school and be a better example for my daughters. If you freeze minimum wage, I will have to quit school and get a second job, which will also have to put my children into daycare. And they will have to take and be woken up late at night out of a stranger's house and brought back home because I would have to work night shifts where the tips are better. This will hurt my family. It'll hurt my family structure. I don't get all the extra bumps that a lot of single people do because I'm struggling as a mother. I'm afraid that if you freeze minimum wage now, that it will open up the door to lower our minimum wage to $2.59 an hour. And then, where am I to go? The only skills I have for the last 15 years is being a food server. And the reason why I'm trying to get a better education is so that I don't have to work at minimum wage and so that I can have better medical benefits. This is just a stepping stone for me, and it's helping me make a better life for my children and a better future for them as well. So I ask you very much so to please consider not freezing the minimum wage and let me be able to continue making a better role model for my children. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Tim. Tim, you brushed over a couple of points that I felt were pretty important. What is the Department of Labor's average of what wait staff make in this state?
Mr. Chair and Representative Shields, in the second packet we gave you today, we have the detail from the Oregon Employment Department, which then the data is a year old. So we adjusted for the 20 cent an hour minimum wage increase in January. We adjusted for meal price increases and used some the best data we could find on potential underreporting of tips. And kind of stretching it as far as we could, the average comes to $9.98 per hour.
And that's $17 an hour. Where does that come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, that comes from the Restaurant Association's brochure, which I think they said is based on a survey.
Any other questions? Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for you, Mr. Nesbitt. I was curious if you have any data on what percentage of the workforce in the restaurant industry have health care.
Chair Brown and Representative Holby, we do not, and we've had the same problem trying to identify employers who might say they offer health care but in fact have such stringent eligibility requirements that, in fact, very few of their employees receive that health care. So I don't have any statistical source of data on that for that industry, Representative.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
If I may, of course, this is purely anecdotal. I have never received benefits on any job in this industry, and I've worked many years. It has been my experience that it is not terribly common, at least for smaller businesses, to offer benefits. And it's not terribly common for waiters to work over 40 hours a week. And so in there, you know, if a business does offer benefits, do they offer them for less than 40 hours a week? I feel I can in all confidence say that most of us are not receiving benefits.
Yeah.
At a prestigious restaurant, my ex-husband has been offered medical benefits, and he has to pay $300 or more a month in premiums. On top of that, he has to pay 20% of the doctor visit and a copayment. That's what they give to him. So, and that's pretty standard for most of the restaurant business.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tim, thanks for being here, and thank you folks for being here as well. On page one of your testimony, this one that you passed out, you go on under dot, I will call it, bullet point 2.2, you describe here a reasonable level. I just wonder if you could elaborate on that. What exactly are you defining as a reasonable level, and how do you derive at that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kitts, it's not my definition, but if you look at the top of page 10 in that document, this is a calculation done and adjusted every year or two by a group called the Northwest Federation of Community Organizations. It's their job gap study. It's the best data we've found over the years to identify what we would call a living wage, a wage that can support a family with reasonable benefits, a couple weeks of vacation a year. In other words, not quite living on the edge. And that's the data we have there by the hour.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
If that's the definition of living wage, I think we've had this discussion prior, but
if your definition of a living wage is $10.85 an hour, why not raise the minimum wage to $10.85 an hour? If that's the ultimate goal here.
Representative Brown, I'm sorry, Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, we have had this discussion before, and I think my answer is the same. The minimum wage,
I'm just checking,
is just that. It's a minimum wage. And it was established at the level it is now, not arbitrarily, but because it's just enough to keep an adult with one dependent above the poverty line. Not quite enough to do more than that, but that's why we call it a minimum wage.
And I think we also discussed last session possibly trying to work to incorporate the minimum wage for legislators as well. Have you made any progress on that?
And how about wage and hour laws, 40-hour work week?
Thank you, Tim, for answering my
Here's
question.
Here's my tip jar, Mr. Chair, in case anybody wants to.
Chair Brown and Representative Kitts, you mentioned a minimum wage, and like you said, that's what it is. It's not a livable wage. Even if I were to work 40 hours a week, I still could not provide for my kids properly. I would not be able to give them the basis, the basics that they need to survive, to get through each month. So minimum wage is not a livable wage.
Thank you for that definition.
Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, thank you. You're right, Miss. It is $10.85 an hour for a single person, or $17.60 for a single person with a child. You are surviving, is what you're doing. It's a survivable wage. My question, though, is to Mr. Nesbitt. You were here and involved through the campaign putting this in law. Do you remember any conversation about commissioned wait staff? And I guess my question to the wait staff in front of us are, have you ever worked in a restaurant that paid you by commission? Have you ever, does that very frequently happen?
No.
Is it legal for a restaurant to provide commission and then make them exempt from the minimum wage laws? I guess I'll have to find a lawyer to answer this question.
I could only give you my best guess answer to that, Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler. If tips are provided as tips, they're voluntary, they're determined by the customer, they're not set by the employer. I think there's no legal way for the employer in any way to divert or capture those tips. Mm-hmm. If commissions, and this is what distinguishes a commission from a tip, commissions are set by employers. They're part of the compensation package when someone is hired. And unlike tips, by the way, because restaurant owners do pay payroll taxes on tips, but they get a refund for what they pay. Also a unique treatment under the IRS. But if I suppose there's no legal prohibition against marking up one's menu tab with a commission rate. But we all know that's not how it's done, and that still would not make a commission a tip or a tip a commission.
Thank you.
I did work at a place that had commission for parties of eight or more. This was back in 94, and they did that for a year and a half. After complaints of certain guests that would come into the establishment, they took that off, and therefore we had to just work for whatever we get. And that's the deal. I haven't worked in an establishment since then.
Representative Kitts.
Very briefly, in relation to what you're saying, I was just at a restaurant this weekend, and it said an automatic gratuity of 15% will be added for parties of eight or more. How is that set by the pay? How is that different in a situation like this?
It is my understanding that cannot legally be collected on. For instance, not that you ever would, Mr. Kitts, but say you decided you weren't going to pay that tip and you just left. As far as I understand, that wouldn't be handled by the police or whatever authority in the same way as if you didn't.
These are hypotheticals, right?
Pardon me? And I do know that credit card slips will allow for the gratuity. It'll say suggested gratuity because I believe that credit card companies can't enforce it themselves. You can't take it to say somebody chooses not to add the suggested gratuity. You cannot go into their account with their credit card and take it that way. But you, in theory, if you have their credit card number and they didn't pay for their meal, you could certainly just take it out.
This is an option, although it says automatically will be added. So it's not a suggested. It's if my bill is $100, it then shows up $115. that's my bill. They automatically added it in parties of eight or more. I just wanted to know how that, because you really walk a fine line there between it being up to me, the patron, versus set by the establishment at that point in time.
I would say just sort of imagine if you're in the restaurant's perspective and you're expecting this gratuity, you would tend to want to word it as this has been added. It really is my understanding. It's not legally enforceable. I've never had an experience at the same time where somebody tried not to pay it. It's not something that we're dealing with on a regular basis, you know. So I would say that it's a fact that is paid and that is a reality.
Thank
but
you.
I don't think it's quite the same as a commission sale.
Representative Escobar.
Yeah, it's just on this particular subject, which has nothing to do with this bill. I don't think I need to pay you unless you earn it.
You're right.
That's why I resent that very much when I see these things, and I've seen them, because you earn it. You either earn a penny from me, and I always tip, or you earn 20% or 25%, depending upon your performance.
If you will, with that mentality, please remember, as the Restaurant Association was clear to us, sir, we are taxed on what it is assumed that we were tipped. So at that point, you know, and I agree with you. I, as a server, have the option to tack on gratuity on parties of eight or more. I don't do it. I don't do it because I don't like that mentality. I like to get a 20% tip at that point and call that a success because I know that I created that.
I have to agree with you, Representative. I feel that tips are not guaranteed, and there are some days that I walk away with nothing. I work in a community where people live on pensions and young families, so it's not guaranteed that they're going to leave me 15% to 20%. Sometimes, if they leave me 50 cents, it's because that's all that they can afford. And I'm very thankful that they were able to give what they can.
Representative Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Last question.
This is my last question. I've been sort of focusing on health care. I'm curious to the young woman with the two daughters. You don't have health care. How do you pay for your health care?
I have one of them that is eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. My other daughter is not because her father has health insurance on her. I still have to pay the 20%, and I have to pay the copayment. So, and I do not have health insurance on myself, so it's out of the pocket expenses for me.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks, for testifying. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being here. And thank you, sir, for coming all the way to Portland today.
Thank you for your time.
Committee Commissioner Dan Gardner was scheduled originally to be here today, and he's ill, I understand, and so he has written testimony that he will provide for us. Could I have Representative Diane Rosenbaum and Jeff Richardson, please? Thank you, Representative, for your patience this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative for House District 42 in Southeast Portland. Very pleased to appear in front of you today, and I do so in opposition to House Bill 2409. I, along with Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner, was one of the chief petitioners who went out in the rain day after day and collected signatures to put ballot measure 25 on the ballot. And on November 4th of 2002, voters said that they wanted to give a raise with an annual cost of living increase to those hardworking people, some of whom you have just heard from. And when they did that, they didn't say, we want to give a raise to some people who work in stores, but not to people that work in restaurants, people who are over 18, but not to people that are younger than 18. They said, we want to give this raise to all Oregon workers who show up and work hard every day. And that is what they said. And that is really why we're here today in what has become an event almost as regular as the blooming of the cherry trees on the mall down the street. I think it's really important, and I'll keep my testimony brief because I want you to hear from more of the real people affected by this, but to remember that we're talking about people, two-thirds of whom are women. One out of four are supporting at least one other person in addition to themselves. And I also want to ask you to think about not necessarily the restaurants where typically legislators would go to eat, nice high-end places like Alessandro's. But I'd suggest, Mr. Chair, the committee might want to take a field trip over to the Denny's restaurant at the Mill Creek Inn here in Salem, where you can get a pretty healthy dinner for $15. And when you think about what a tip at 15% would be on that meal, we're talking $2.25. And I would put it to you that those are the people that we're talking about, too, not the people necessarily that are working in some of these high-end restaurants. I also want to talk about a couple of the myths that I think you have already heard today and say why I think they are myths. One is that we're not reducing wages for anybody. We're really just keeping the wage where it is. Well, you know, let's get real. Voters are not fools, and neither are the people that are working at these jobs. If somebody next to me is getting a raise and I'm not, then that is reducing my wages. And if I'm getting the same wage I was a year ago, to say that I've suffered no reduction really seems pretty disingenuous. And the other thing is about the redistributing of the money. You know, if we're going to start talking about redistributing what people earn, maybe we should start talking about Tim Nesbitt's wages. You know, I'm sure he gets a pretty good paycheck. Well, maybe the secretaries in his office would like to see his wages frozen so they could get a raise. Or maybe the CEO's wages should be looked at so that people who are cleaning the buildings could get a raise. If we want to start somewhere, maybe that would be a more logical place to start, but not here. And why is it that the proponents of House Bill 2409 are not doing what we did? Why aren't they going out in the rain and collecting signatures and putting this in front of voters? Well, we know why they're not, because voters would say exactly what they said in 2002, that they want a fair wage for a fair day's work for all the 100,000 Oregon workers that we're talking about. So please do not take your pencil and erase what voters have said, and do not put your hand in the pocket of hardworking people who go to work every day, who support themselves and in many cases support their families and are trying to work hard and escape poverty. Please say no to House Bill 2409. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Jeff, would you like to give your testimony, please?
Yeah, my name is Jeff Richardson, Executive Officer for the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, Local 9, which covers all of Oregon, Southern Washington. I was going to say basically what Tim and Diane and everybody else has said up here, but listening to the gentleman from the Oregon Restaurant Association and the employer, then my mind is swimming at the moment. The lady employer is talking that she knows that the IRS knew that these employees were making $150 a day. I have questions. I want to know how do they know they were making $150 a day. And I would like to work in her establishment. I will start tomorrow. Also, I'm fearful. I mean, this is my industry. And according to the gentleman from the Oregon Restaurant Association, we are in dire straits that all the restaurants are going to shut down in Oregon. Now, the other fact is that Oregon has more restaurants per capita than any other city in the United States, and it's growing. Representative, problem there? I see you scowling.
Well, you said Oregon and then city, and I'm having...
Oh, I'm sorry, Portland. Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Portland. Thank you.
Yeah, the state of Portland.
Pretty much the state, of Portland. You know, more people in that Portland area than anywhere else. And that's not the fact. You need to pay a decent wage to have good employees. I know the employers that I have and the members I represent are thankful, and some of them pay more than the minimum wage because they know they don't have the cost of training and turnover. People are working right now, but we have employees that have worked 35 years as servers and longer. If you lower this minimum wage, you are not going to have the employees that are going to take care of the guest. Because the people that are making this income that they are now, which is not a livable wage, or just about there, they're going to have to go off and look for other jobs. Because I know in my survey, just like the Oregon Restaurant Association, I can tell you that the majority, the vast majority, does not have health care. They can't afford it. There is no way in hell they can afford it. These employers get these plans, and it costs so much that they would be working just to pay for their health care. And it's not fair. Another question I would like to ask to the employers with all these surveys they've done is that would they be willing to open up their books? I mean, it sounds like they're crying poverty. Be more than willing to bring in independent auditors and look at their books and see. They're saying that these employees are driving new cars and paying their way and buying houses. What do they have? Okay, I'm sure they're sending their children through college. They have health care. They drive nice cars, live in nice houses. They're turning it around, and I don't believe it's fair. So I would ask them, any employer, please contact me. I'll give you the number. We can go in, and let's look at the books and see what they're making and see if it's fair. We're not asking to be 50% owners with these employers. Just pay a fair wage. So.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Kitts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. I was wondering if you could provide a copy of your survey for the committee. I think Representative Holby's had several questions dealing with health care and the survey that you just spoke of. If you could provide a copy of that for the committee, that'd be great.
When I said I did my own survey, it's because I'm in this industry and just from talking to massive amounts of these employees.
So not an actual survey?
No, I said my survey.
Oh, your personal survey.
That's what I said, my survey, yes.
Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, thank you. Representative, what were the election results that put this into law? What was the vote count for the measure that, do you have that off the top of your
head? Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I do not have those numbers in my head, but I can certainly get them to you. It was certainly a decisive result, and that was in spite of the fact that the opponents of this ballot measure outspent the supporters by, I believe, about a 2-to-1 margin.
No, that's
any other questions?
If I may, to the chair and the committee. Also, in the beginning, we were talking about 50 cents less for a training wage for the first 60 days. I've heard nothing about, okay, well, let's balance it out, and let's every year have a cost of living increase. None of the employers have said that. They just want to keep the minimum wage, not even what it is, but lower. It's not fair. It's not fair.
Thank you, folks, for your testimony. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Janet?
Mr. Chair, the result of Measure 25 in 2002 was 645,016 in favor and 611,658 opposed. So approximately 645,000, 611,000.
Thank you, Janet. Can I have Mike Downing, Matt Charnell, is that how you pronounce it, and Gracie Strom? Hey, Gracie.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is actually Matt Harner, H-A-R-N-E-R.
Okay.
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here this morning and to hear everyone's side and everyone's opinion. I'm a waiter and bartender at the same time for Mike Downing at Quimby's in Newport, Oregon. I've worked at about a dozen different restaurants over the period of, since I was 17, I'm 25 now, and I started in restaurants in the back of the house as a cook and dishwasher, and I've worked my way up in terms. I've done fine dining and fine casual dining between Oregon, mostly in Newport, here in Salem as well. I worked at the Olive Garden for a year and another bar downtown on the Stern Wheeler. And I've worked in Arizona as well where they pay $2.15. I was there a year ago. And I think that one of the biggest problems is that it does affect the business owner. It does affect, in terms of it comes back to me as the employee, and it cuts down on the amount of service that I can give to my customers. A common example is there's Matt and I, the other Matt, and it's him and I on the floor, and we get busy, and we're okay through the first rush, but more people come in, and we're understaffed because it's the middle of winter, and we get a weird rush because of the theater across the street, and we have no way to reset the tables for the second round, so service drops. What instantly goes away is a wine presentation and a nice formal greeting to the table. The next thing that goes away is the dessert tray being brought out, and it's a, would you care for dessert? And if they do, you kind of go, oh no, I'm in trouble now. I've really got to run. And I've, you know, worked in restaurants where I've done $500 to $2,000, $3,000 in sales, and can hold my own with a lot of different waiters. I'm not going to name any names or the restaurant where they work, but I know personally several waitresses who make $60,000 on the Oregon coast in tips and have kept track personally of the amount of money they make. And I support my wife and son working right around, my last paycheck was 28 hours in 2 weeks. And yes, things are tight, but during the winter, we don't have internet. We get rid of cable TV. And, you know, I consider that a luxury and not a necessity personally. And during the summer, we take care of stuff that needs to be done when there's an excess of money. Hopefully, we're not living paycheck to paycheck, and we're saving and being good stewards of the money we're making. It's very easy to have a wad of cash. When I was 18, 19, working at the Olive Garden, I oftentimes would go out with friends afterwards who are making this barely livable wage and go to the casino every Sunday night. This was a number of years ago. I've since then changed my lifestyle. Gone to the casino every Sunday night and blew whatever tips I made, whether I made money at the casino or lost money, bars, you know, parties. And it's kind of a lifestyle that represents I would say, a percentage of the waiters and bartenders out there, that there's the after work party that takes place. And it's possible because I'm doing it to, as an example, last week I made $180 in tips and 5 hours, 6 hours plus cleanup and closing down. And given there was plenty of nights during the winter, I made $50 a night. And it comes back to stewardship, in my opinion, and being responsible with the money you make. Minimum wage is nothing to me. My paycheck is $100 to $150. I've never, as a server, had more than a $150 paycheck. If you're counting on that to live as a server, I feel like there's something that needs to change in your lifestyle. Personally, I hold that view. And I know there's always exceptions to every case, but I think we need to do what's best for the majority of people. In Arizona, we were able to run a higher floor staff, provide better service, and make more money. Your tip goes up. It's easy to lose sight, too, of what tip means. There's some speculation, but tip means to ensure promptness. And I believe that we're looking for return customers, patrons who come to the restaurant specifically seeking service, and it's based on relationship. Not always. There's the tourist industry that we glean from, but I've waited on tourists one summer to the next summer and have waiter customers who follow me to the restaurant that I happen to work at, because I wouldn't work for anyone, as I have a choice in where I work. In this state and in this country, I wouldn't work somewhere where I was treated, and I've moved restaurants, I've changed, treated less than how I feel I should be treated, or paid what I feel, or not making what I feel. We have a choice where we work. We don't have to work for less than $9 an hour. If you're a server, you can say, this is how much I require to wait tables, and I want $9 an hour, or I'm happy with minimum. Personally, I could care less if it was $2.15 an hour. My paycheck is not what it's about. On the East Coast, there's places where you rent spaces and you pay money in a restaurant to wait tables. You know, you have your four tables, your five tables, that's Matt's section. And you pay $200 to the restaurant to do that. Let me go over my notes here 1 second, and I'm talking fast because I know there's a lot of people who have a lot to say. And I want to be considerate. As a cook, I saw that the money was in the front of the house and quickly did what was necessary to render that situation to my advantage. I I worked my way from the back of the house to the front of the house, and I have some college, gone to three different schools, and haven't completed my college. I had a child in the way, but I do continue on. This isn't a career. This is just simply taking care of business. And I would say that $10 an hour is a very low, just from my personal experience in a dozen different restaurants in two different states, is a low, and three different cities, is a very low average that I see from me, myself, and the people I've worked around. And I've also been in management, helped open restaurants. So I've been on the service end, the server, the lower end, the minimum wage end, the upper end. I've seen it from a lot of different sides, and I think that probably a better number is somewhere right around $20-$25 for me personally, pushing 30. I had a $66 check, and somebody just the other night, which this isn't that uncommon, left me $30 tip, the difference from a $100 bill. And same thing with another waitress I worked with, a $40 tip.
Matt, we are going to run out
of
time.
And that's all I have to say. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And I can tell you how you got the $180 last Saturday night, because I was in your restaurant there. I had a very good
thank
meal.
You very much, Chairman.
Mike.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, you can see why he makes a lot of money and talks a lot. But anyway, I'm not a real eloquent speaker or anything like that. I'm just basically a chef. I've been for 37 years. I've owned a couple of restaurants. This is the Wendy's now. It's a struggle where we are on the coast of Oregon, just not because the minimum wage is only, it's because it's the coast of Oregon. It's a tough town. Tourism, you rely a lot on tourism and stuff like that. The minimum wage is, first off, I don't think we're talking about lowering the minimum wage, are we? We're talking about just freezing it at this point. Secondly, The cost to the restaurant is just abhorrent. I can't begin to tell you how much it takes. If anybody wants to look at my books, you're welcome to come over, by the way. I pay $12,000 to $15,000 a month for every 4 weeks in labor. You're talking about it on the coast of Oregon, that's enough to kill you. I don't make money myself in the summer, in the wintertime. Luckily enough, my wife's a teacher, so we have a little bit of income, and we have insurance. And no, I don't include insurance in my restaurant because, quite frankly, nobody could afford to do it, especially me. I like the business, and I just don't realize the struggle it is for all these small restaurants in this state, and that's most of the restaurants. They're small, independently owned restaurants. They're not big chains. They're people trying to make it, and it's not easy. It's just killing us. It's there's just not enough customers to go around. Newport, they open up a restaurant every couple of weeks, it seems like, and then another one fails and all that stuff, because there's only so many slices of the pie. In the big cities, like call Salem and Portland, whatever, Eugene, there's more people to go around. It does help, but still, there's also a lot more restaurants, so everybody's suffering. But my waiters are not suffering. They're making a lot of money. I don't know if it's because we do a good job or if it's because they do a good job or the back of the house does a good job, but they make good money. I have my lead waiter, who works about 40 hours a week for me, averages 23% in tips. That's a lot of money. He brings in a lot. He's a very good waiter. He works an awful lot, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, even if you do take your minimum amount of a tip, if you get $1.50 for a table or $2 for a table, if you take 10 tables, it's more money. It's still $15 an hour. And nobody is not, I know that a Denny's or a Sherry's, I know that there's less tips and things like that. And I appreciate that, and I know it must be harder. But how can you expect the restaurant owner to pay all these different bills? It's not just the wages. It's the, the sewer goes up, the water, the electricity, the food. Everything keeps going up. There's a limit on what we can charge for a 6-ounce piece of chicken. There is a limit. It's tough. And, and as far as, your your microsystems, your computers, all that is the way you monitor all this stuff. That's how we know what the waiters are making, because, you know, basically, and what they report. And we see all this when they do their checkouts and stuff. Anyway, I don't want to keep going on because she speaks a lot better than I do. And I just want you to know that keeping this minimum wage, if it goes up again next year, it goes up. I am not hiring more people. I can't give the service that we need to give in order to keep the status of the restaurant the way it is. And it makes it very, very difficult on my employees. The cooks notwithstanding, it's obviously difficult on them to see the waiters making more and more money. So we do have to bump the cooks up. But the waiters also, because I can't afford to hire an extra busser or even another waiter, it's just a catch-22. I'm just going around in circles and just trying to make ends meet. And that's all I got to say, I guess.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your testimony. Good morning, Gracie.
Good morning, Representative Brown.
I brought some bottles for you to play.
Oh, well, one thing about it, I can keep playing, see, because I don't have to pay myself first. But I have owned the Sea Hag Restaurant for 41 years. Now, that's a lot of years, more than some of you up there are old enough to do. But,
where are you going with this?
But it's been a fun, fun place to do. But what we're planning on now is, I used to think, well, death and taxes were the only thing that we really had to count on. But now I've just made to believe that we have to now count on raising the minimum wage every year. And as I've read it, it's just automatic. I can't think of anything that's just automatic. And it's like, well, I listened to the gentleman say, if you want to really make it, you I don't know how you do make it. When you keep everything raising, we have to pay matching funds on Social Security. And I have the perfect example, because I have one cook that's been with me for 40 years of the 41 I've been there. And I know we always thought we'd have to prop her up. That's why I'm using the cane. But what she did was start out as a waitress years ago, because that looked like the best deal. And then, oh, she'd been from Surf Point, I think, Inn, which was a fancy place. And so she wanted to be a cook, because that made more money than waitresses. So, boy, she moved up to be a cook, and she said, that was the dumbest thing I ever did, because the cooks just don't make the... We pay well. We have a payroll of over $700,000 in our place, which, when it gets going up, our percentage of payroll is above and beyond the accepted medium. And I advertise for, we never really have to advertise for wait people. Well, you can certainly see why after you see what they testify they do. And none of them, as I said, and as the other speaker said, if they don't make the minimum wage, you get rid of them. So, of course, everybody makes the minimum wage, but the people on the back of the house don't get their automatic raises. Now, if you, it's like the Hatfields and the McCoys, if you don't give the back of the house regular raises, and we always do, because the people we have are last. I have not had to advertise for a wait person. So many men now have applied, which in my day and age was an all-woman, you know, place for cooks and everything. But nowadays, nobody wants to be a cook, because the most you ever give them is, we never give them any tips. I let my people parlay all their tips. They keep them. We pay matching funds, so most of them are very, very happy to get to have the raises and get the Social Security included in, so they get more Social Security. I'm rambling now. But I put an order in for a headline cook, thinking, oh, I'll get many, many people to apply. I got three people that applied. One of them, I think, was a jail reject, and the second one said he'd had 15 years experience, and I think he was about 25 years old. And I absolutely, to this day, and I advertise on the internet, I advertise on the employment agency, and I advertise in the newspaper, our local newspapers even, and got three people. I still don't have one. So that sure certainly shows that we're off on the left field the way we're operating now. Because if we automatically, it's just that automatic thing, it's ridiculous, I think. I'm Drew. I'm Drew Early.
Thank you, Christy. Any questions, Representative Schlafly?
Thank you. I spent many pleasant hours after fishing one day in your fine establishment. Is the sea hag really haunted?
People always ask. I had Smuggler's Cove, and people did think it was haunted. I don't think it is. I just know it's a fun place, and
it is.
I get a lot of requests, but I play the bottles anyway.
Any other questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Hunter. Thank you so much for coming, all of you. And as somebody who's worked for TGI Fridays, and while I was working my way through life, my concern is not so much Ms. Caldwell and a lot of the other good folks here who have small businesses, but you know, it's been my experience that employers, they'll pay what the market will bear. They'll pay what they have to get good people. My question is that if you know, looking at how the Olive Garden does business, don't you think that they would pay what the market would bear in the back of the house? And if you gave them a break on tip wages, don't you think there's a chance they might just hold on to the money?
I do think there is a clarification. There is a difference in my mind, from my perspective, of what would happen, how it would affect corporate restaurants, and how it would affect small businesses. I think that... for me, I know that it would affect me positively where I'm at right now, and I would. It's a lot easier to stay at one place, one restaurant, and you know, if something like that, if I was at Olive Garden or another corporate restaurant, and saw that take place, I think that that would be. And didn't see the money coming back into the restaurant and affecting me positively. Because if the cooks are happy, I'll tell you guys, the floor staff's happy, and one begets the other. When the cooks are making money and they come in and they're thankful for the job they have and they're free, you know, they're free to really be themselves and not be worried about bills, stressed out about how much they make. I mean, I started at $7 an hour. $6.50 an hour as a cook, and I was completely miserable. I said, I'm done. I can't do this for $7 an hour, 50-cent raise over a year as a cook. And the waitresses, I just see, you know, wads of cash, and I'm going, I'm in the wrong side of this window. And I, to answer your question, I think that it would be nice to see, of course, that money go back into, but we can't answer for the corporate restaurants. I don't think they're affected. They can take a wash on labor. They can absorb the cost of that, whereas a small business can't, because it's one person. The corporate structure is set up in such a way where it can absorb that cost of running high labor if need be. That's more. No, anything else?
Thank you very much for your testimony today. Thank you, Gracie, for coming down.
I enjoyed it.
All right, thank you. Could I have David Brown and Adam Petkum and Sarah Ramos? And we're ready.
No, you won't. Did you say something?
If I could ask you folks a couple minutes each, and then maybe we can get as many people as possible. We're fast running out of time. Thank you for coming today.
I can
go right
see,
out.
See the clock is moving forward. My name is David Brown, and I worked as a bellman at the Portland Hilton and worked for minimum wage plus tips. And like most Americans, I didn't really get into the service industry to make a fortune. It's not the kind of industry that people build empires out of. And I got into make a living to pay my mortgage, pay my bills, be a productive citizen. And for me, this just represents a step backwards. It sounds like the thin end of the wedge. And if you can freeze it at one level, then continuing on to lower the incremental wages. excuse my voice is disappearing. And much mention has been made of the 43 states that do have a tip credit, and I say shame on them. I say, I think Oregon's a fine example of how to keep the economy going, how to keep people's lives at above poverty level, and minimum wage jobs. You also hear a lot of anecdotal evidence from restaurants about how, you know, waiters are driving Lexuses and the owners are driving Hondas, and you know, it's just there's an equal, if not greater, amount of anecdotal evidence for the opposite. Just a lot of the people working minimum wages, single parents raising families, and there's no cost. There's the cost of living are continuing to increase. I mean, there's no relief. It's not exactly the cost of gasoline or your PG&E bill is going down, and if your salary is going down, then you're squeezed. You're sometimes required to take a second job, and in many cases, that's what I do. We're a two-income family. My wife also works as in a restaurant, South Park in Portland, and she was doing it while she was going to school. And again, that was another thing that was brought up, was that these are summer jobs, these are part-time jobs, and for many people, they're professionals. These are full-time jobs. These are how they make a living. You can question their decisions for getting into the industry, but certainly they are in the industry, and that's their career. I think in America, the jobs are thought there's a certain social kind of imbalance, and I've been traveling in Europe. Jobs like that are professions. I mean, people are professional waiters, and they're paid as such. You go into a restaurant, the tip is automatically added, and I've yet to really have bad service. I mean, other than just sort of language barriers, but it's people go into it because they can make a living, because it's a profession here. Sometimes people just fall into it for whatever reason they do, and other people choose it, you know, actively choose it. And I don't think these people should be penalized. And that's as much as I have to say for now.
Thank you, David. Go ahead, Adam.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Adam Petkin. I am the chair of the Oregon Student Association Board and the president of the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. I am here to speak in opposition to House Bill 2409. OSA represents over 100,000 students in post-secondary education across Oregon, including all OUS campuses, Lane Community Colleges, and Oregon Health and Sciences University. The OSA board voted to oppose this bill and others that would erode the state's minimum wage approved by voters. OSA came to this conclusion because we believe such changes would have a negative impact on the large number of students who must support themselves through such jobs, or for those still in high school hoping to attain a higher education. Recently, the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education released its national survey on affordability in post-secondary education. As many of you know, Oregon received an F in affordability. And while there are a great many states that receive such a grade, only three states scored lower than Oregon in this category. Why do Oregon citizens face such an ominous distinction? Here are some of the facts. Since 1989, public universities across Oregon have raised tuition over 177%, more than three times the same increase in the consumer price index. Oregon's community colleges rank in the top 20 nationwide for high community college tuition. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, Oregon's only state-based need-based financial aid for low-income students, is among the worst-funded state aid programs in the nation, with Oregon spending just $5.81 per resident compared to the national average of $13.57. This historically anemic level of support allows the grant to finance only 11% of the cost of education for low-income Oregonians. Last, 40% of Oregon families with the lowest income spend half of their total income to support a student at OUS school, and 43% to support a student at a community college. For college students or high school students saving for college, minimum wage jobs such as those in restaurants are often the best and only options available. According to the Oregon Unemployment Department, the average earnings of waiters and waitresses vary by region from a high of $9.45 per hour in Jackson and Josephine counties down to $7.50 per hour in Klamath and Lake counties. So, while income may be lower depending upon the region in which Oregon students live, the price of a college education is not correspondingly low. Creating a sub-minimum wage for tipped workers, it would negatively impact all young Oregonians in these jobs, but especially those in counties already facing lower than average incomes. For Oregonians already struggling to save and invest in their own education and their future, House Bill 2409 would further raise these barriers to attaining a post-secondary education. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify for you today.
Thank you, Adam. Sarah?
Good morning, Chair Brown, representatives. I'll go really quickly because I know we don't have very much time, but I do have a lot of things that I wanted to speak about. I'm currently employed as one of the managers at a local pub that's just right outside of downtown Salem. I've seen some of you in there before, people in this room. Frequent that place a lot.
Where are you going with this?
It's a restaurant. We have really good food. but I've worked in the industry for 9 years, you know, and it's been since I was 15, 16 years old. Started out working in a fast food restaurant while I worked at high school. I had to get a job in order to buy school necessities. My father's disabled, and my parents were on welfare when I grew up. My job, while I was under 18, was not to go buy clothes at the mall and have fun with my friends. My job was to pay for my lunch at school. It was to pay for my school clothes. It was to pay for supplies. And a below minimum wage pay for me doesn't seem like that would be very fair, nor would it be fair to the people that are under 18 right now going through the same thing that I went through. Throughout my years, I've held a lot of different positions, currently managing, but I've been just a regular employee before, and I've seen a lot of people in a lot of different situations. I've met people that make a lot of money waiting tables, but the majority of the people I meet don't make very much, and it's a struggle to survive. And there's single mothers, there's, you know, people that don't have any health insurance, that have medical bills that they have to pay out of their pockets, you know, $150 emergency room visits, and no insurance to cover it. I guess what I'm saying is that I've seen it. I've seen it all. You know, I've had medical bills, $30,000 that my health insurance denied claims on. I've worked a job where that $5 in tips I got at a coffee shop meant that I had $5 to go towards my rent, towards my electric bill. You know, it's not much money. It's not much at all. And currently I work a job where I work really hard, where I've worked in the industry for a long time to have gotten this position. And I'm tired at the end of the night. I run around, my feet hurt, I carry trays, you know, constantly rushing, and I make a living wage, but by no means am I wealthy. And my family is not wealthy. My sister has an 8-year-old daughter that she got pregnant with when she was 16. She worked to support her daughter and herself. Would she have deserved a below minimum wage? No, she's a mother, a single mother. And, I mean, currently, the money that I make, any extra money I have, will go to help her pay for medical bills. She has no health insurance. My niece has no health insurance. And to say that I deserve to have my wages frozen, that anyone in my circumstance or below my circumstances deserves to have their wages frozen, doesn't make any sense to me, because these costs of living are going to continue to go up. Health insurance is continue to go up. Those things don't get cheaper. So why should we have to make less when those things continue to rise? That's all.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. And we'll move on. I'll get the next panel. Steve Klein, Lawrence Goglin, and Jessica Watson.
2 minutes.
Good morning.
Good morning. You know, these things almost become ritualized. Real studies on one side, real studies on the other. Informal studies on one side, informal studies on the other. The media likes to keep things up into a... I don't think this is an issue of management of the labor. I don't think it's Republicans against everything. I think it's about jobs. I think it's about fairness.
And I realize that fairness itself is a fairly slippery word because it depends on who is defined.
You know, excuse me, sir. I'm not sure. Did we get you to identify yourself?
Steve Klein. I'm sorry. Okay.
Thank you.
I'm a member of the board of directors for the Restaurant Association.
Thank you.
We talk about what guarantees are there that restaurants will reinvest their money. In my experience, I've certainly known that there are restaurateurs who will not do that. I've seen some restaurateurs exploit workers, just as I've seen some servers not always be forthcoming
but I think by and large the majority of workers are trying to do their very best. I think the majority of restaurant owners are trying to do their best. Our servers are our front lines. We try to treat them very well. We are not required to pay health insurance. We're not required to pay benefits. But my wife and I are very proud of the fact that we're one of the smallest companies probably that provides what I think are pretty extraordinary benefits. We provide paid vacations. We provide health insurance. Our health insurance package has included wellness programs, massage therapy, chiropractic, naturopathic, dental, eye exams and glasses. Recently we have had to increase our minimums. We didn't increase the copay. This last year our prices have gone up so much we were within a whisker of canceling the benefits because we couldn't afford it. I don't know if we'll be able to afford it next year. Because we did not cancel the benefits, interestingly, one of our employees, it's probably saved his life. He just received a kidney transplant. So these issues, we're dealing with a very complicated whole. If we have to keep paying more and more wages, obviously we have to cut where we can somewhere else, not necessarily where we want to. I don't know how, you know, if this were a government-mandated program, if the minimum wage were a government-mandated program, I don't know what would happen if a reporter found, well, gee, people who are also making an additional $10 or $15 or $30 an hour qualify for minimum wage. The tips are certainly part of income as far as the IRS is concerned. As a restaurant, we go out of our way to do everything we can to make sure that our servers have the maximum possible income that they get. We don't just add a server when we increase our business. We go out of our way to say, can we add a busser? Can we add a food runner to help that server and have a minimum impact on the overall tips so that the servers continue to make the greatest possible tips? Because only when your servers are making the most tips can they be happiest, can you get the best server, the best individual in the job, and you'll get retention of good, solid employees. Most of our employees are with us for many years. So I guess my simple thing is to say it's not an easy issue, I realize that. But what is fair? And again, not what is fair for management versus labor. What is fair for the people of Oregon? What is fair for the overall perspective when, as far as the IRS is concerned, tips are wages? And we're in a program now that seems to be working against itself because we've had to cut a couple of people last year. These were high-paid people. We didn't cut our hourly workers. But I can see, I know a lot of restaurants are cutting hourly workers in the kitchen. When your vendors come to you and say, well, we can get you pre-mixed salads, we can get you already cut and peeled and deveined shrimp, a lot of restaurants are taking that on and they're cutting servers. We have 9,000 restaurants in the state, and the state was very excited to have the governor come back with a company that was bringing in 200 jobs. Well, if we have six restaurants and we cut two jobs, and if every three restaurants is at least cutting a job, if we can save a job or add a job for 3,000 restaurants, that dwarfs what we've been doing lately in our recruitment efforts for businesses. Every restaurant owner, every business owner in America knows that it is cheaper and more effective to focus on the customers you have and increase your business that way than it is to try to attract new customers. And I think maybe the state should be looking at keeping the businesses we have healthy and growing them and protecting those workforces rather than elsewhere. Thank you.
Go ahead, sir.
My name's Lawrence Scobin. My wife and I own and operate a small restaurant in Northeast Portland called Milo City Cafe. My real contention here is that if the intent of the initiative that raised the minimum wage and put the indexing in was to give the people who made the least amount of money an increase in their wages,
I'm not sure anybody who has worked in a restaurant before or does now would say that a server makes less money than a tipped employee that declares those tips makes less money than the kitchen, the dishwashers and the cooks and the prep people. I just think it's common sense that when they're making their gratuities, that they're making more than the $8, $9, $10 an hour that the people in the back are making. So if the intent was to give the least paid people more money, then we're not really doing that with this law. So how do we fix that? Well, we're looking for a tip credit. We have, in our little restaurant, we've got 33 employees. Most of them are full-time employees. About half of them are tipped wage, or tipped employees. We provide health benefits for anybody who works more than 30 hours a week. And it's a good plan. Sounds very much like yours. We just are in the process of starting a simple IRA. Because we hire adults, we think it's important that they provide for their future, and if nothing else, provide for their health benefit now. And so, not to be totally altruistic and always be looking out for my employees, I think it's important that we do that. But it gets back to the idea that the people who are making the least amount of money are getting less. When the minimum wage went up last year and went up this year, I had to give everybody in the front of the house who was making, on at least for the wage they were making from us, I had to give them an increase. Well, because of that, I couldn't give anybody in the back of an increase, just because there's only a certain amount of dollars. I guess I could make a choice and choose to not provide the benefit of the health insurance. Maybe your question about health insurance. Health insurance costs me specifically $1 an hour per employee if they work full time. It's $160, and to make sure the employee really values it, they pay $80 a month. If they didn't value it enough to pay some part of it, then maybe it's not worthy of a benefit to them either. So, you know, we're working in that direction. There really is a finite amount of money that we can spend on that. The standard is 33-35% of your gross goes to labor. We're about 40%. Part of it because of benefits, and part of it because we're still looking for that higher standard of service. I think tips are gratuities, especially when they're declared. They're considered to be income in every sense of the word. They're income when we pay the taxes, when the employee pays the taxes, and when the employer pays matching taxes and pays our workman's comp, and all. When they go to get unemployment benefits, their income, as long as they declared them. If they go get a loan to buy a house or a car, their income. But in this very narrow sense, they're not income, and I don't really think that's fair. And personally, from my point of view, I think that if we were able to provide a credit, a tip credit, against minimum wage for tipped employees who declare their tips and they get to make that choice, then we want to make people in the back happier. We want them to have a little more money and be able to afford their health benefits. And so, from my point of view, I'd pass it along.
Jessica?
Thank you. I'm Jessica Watson. I am the general manager for the Wood and Nickel Pub and Eateries and Max Places, well owned under that corporation. I'm here to speak in favor of 2409, make sure I get my numbers right. And just to say that to bring equality into our establishments would definitely be a benefit to the workers in the front of the house. As far as the relationship between the back of the house and the front of the house, and none of them would argue the fact that what they tip out to the back of the house determines the service they get from them, which then determines their tips. It's one big circle that goes around in these establishments. And to be able to bring equality, letting the front of the house keep their tips and bring the equality to the back of the house with the pay, that would come from this tip law, would be a better situation for all involved, and I think speaking to the big question of what are these owners going to do with this money once it's collected, if this does go forward, speaking from the three establishments, and we also have a big full-service catering portion of our corporation as well, these people are not going to sit quietly if these changes are not made, and if they don't see these changes brought forward, adding bussers in establishments that don't have them, seeing the increase in service from the back of the house, they're not going to sit quietly if they don't see those changes. So I think that's where some of the accountability comes in as well. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, folks, for your testimony today. I appreciate it. And committee and people here, I need to apologize for those that we flat ran out of time and being able to get to their testimony. With that committee, I'm going to...
We have one piece of testimony to add to the record from the... the Ecumenical Ministries, a piece of written testimony.
Okay.
What? One piece of testimony to add to the record.
Do you need a motion to do that?
No.
Just acknowledge. Get it on the record.
Well, then just add it, Janet. Quit wasting our time. Come on, Janet. Jeez, Janet. You know you're the brains of the committee. Start acting like it.
Hey, leave her alone or you're going to be in trouble.
Am I supposed to call this
person? I'll close the...
brains, but he's LeBron. Thank you. That's right.
Have we said everything we need to on this?
We've okay. Said everything.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2409. Come on.
Adjournment.
Anything else, Janet? Nope. We're adjourned.
I don't have anything else.